From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Can the president hide from Henry Hyde? Today, the House Judiciary Committee begins considering whether there's enough evidence to start an impeachment investigation of Bill Clinton. And the World Bank and IMF begin their meetings in Washington, D.C. We'll take a look at Africa and its debt. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Russian envoys have warned President Slobodan Milosevic that NATO may launch airstrikes unless he takes decisive measures to end the humanitarian crisis in the southern province of Kosovo. Fearing any airstrikes, Yugoslav generals put the nation's air defense on high alert, but tried a belated compromise by moving some tanks and other heavy equipment out of Kosovo. The United Nations has demanded that Yugoslavia halt its assault on ethnic Albanians, and NATO has threatened airstrikes. In Berlin, a German NATO general told German radio that NATO action could come within days. This news from Brazil. President Fernando Henrique Cardoso has won a second term despite Brazil's economic meltdown in the last month, becoming the first Brazilian president ever reelected. Cardoso defeated progressive candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva of the Workers' Party. The House Judiciary Committee begins considering today whether there's enough evidence to start an impeachment investigation of President Clinton. If the committee decides an impeachment inquiry is warranted, it would forward its recommendation to the full House for a vote later this week. Democrats want limits placed on the investigation, but Republicans are expected to prevail in their bid for an open-ended impeachment inquiry. Hyde says it's his hope and prayer that the inquiry will be finished by New Year's. Democrats want it over by Thanksgiving. The New Yorker magazine is reporting that the White House ignored Attorney General Janet Reno when she questioned whether evidence linking Osama bin Laden to the bombings of two U.S. embassies in Africa was strong enough to justify retaliatory attacks against Sudan and Afghanistan. The New Yorker piece by Seymour Hersh said Reno believed that the evidence tying bin Laden to the embassy attacks did not meet the Tripoli standard, a gauge used to justify the 1986 bombing of Libya in retaliation for actions by Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Organizers of an anti-abortion rally said hundreds of people stayed away from the protest because bombs had been discovered at two North Carolina women's health clinics. Only about 200 of an expected crowd of 2,000 showed up for this weekend's protest, and several churches backed out because officials did not want to give the impression they were supportive of the bomb scare. On Saturday, bombs were found at the Carolina Women's Medical Clinic and the Hallmark Clinic. Authorities discovered the devices before they exploded, and the clinics, which were both hit by arsonists last month, were closed at the time. Iraq's foreign ministry this weekend condemned what it said was a fresh incursion into northern Iraq by 10,000 Turkish troops chasing rebels of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as the PKK, which is fighting for self-rule in southeast Turkey. In a statement carried by the official Iraqi news agency, an Iraqi foreign ministry spokesperson demanded Turkey withdraw its troops from northern Iraq immediately. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of Russians will take to the streets across the nation later this week to voice their rage over collapsing living standards and demand the resignation of President Boris Yeltsin. The strikes and marches led by labor unions and communists are set to be the largest manifestation of public anger Russia has seen for several years and the toughest test yet for the new government of Prime Minister Primakov. Labor leaders say millions of Russians will boycott work. Police expect crowds of thousands in countless towns, giving their first public vent to anger that has built up for months. Sudan said today it had protested to the UN Security Council over an alleged Ugandan and Eritrean offensive last month in the south of the country. The official Sudan news agency reported the protest one day after a top Ugandan intelligence official said a Sudanese plane dropped bombs in northwestern Uganda. No casualties were reported. A Pennsylvania politician is counting on a public backlash among voters tired of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. A commercial scheduled to air in the Philadelphia market this week for Wendell Young features a dark-haired young woman. She's wearing a blue dress and a beret decorated with a hat pin. The pin, according to the announcer, is a gift from you-know-who. The announcer says, quote, "Some politicians want to spend the next 2 years fighting over these matters, but they wouldn't be fighting for smaller class sizes, lower property taxes, or a patient's bill of rights." The ad concludes that Young is one politician willing to fight for those other issues. Young is running for state representative in an overwhelmingly Republican district of Pennsylvania. And finally, dozens of police and troops blocked a street march today by about 300 students demanding an end to Indonesian military rule. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we said in the news headlines, the House Judiciary Committee beginning consideration today whether there's enough evidence to start an impeachment investigation of President Clinton. And we're joined right now by Robert Henley. He is Democracy Now!'s campaign correspondent and will be with us right through the elections. As today we take a look at the effect of this possible impeachment inquiry, which looks like it is absolutely likely, on congressional races around the country. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about the picture today in the country around congressional races.
I think we should probably start with California because with 52 House seats, it's more than 10% of the House strength. And what we see there presently is 25 Republicans and 27 Democrats. There are six close and very intense races that we want to just quickly identify. Also, that I understand today is the last day to register to vote in California at the end of business today. District 3, which is an open seat which was occupied by Vic Fazio, he's retiring after 10 terms. He won the last race with 54%. And what's happening there is that he kept spending larger and larger amounts of money to get less and less of the vote and squeaking by each time by, you know, smaller margins. I think in 94 he spent $1.6 million and only got 50% of the vote, while his opponent spent $250,000 and got 46% of the vote. And of course, what's going on there is that we have, I guess the Republican is Doug Ose, a millionaire businessman. He's got $1.25 million, and that's the Sacramento and Central Valley area. Then we see in the 10th district, which is easterly suburbs of San Francisco, water is very important here. You see Democrat Ellen Tauscher, and she is an incumbent, but she won the first time in 96 with only 49% of the vote. So here
very
we
close
see,
range,
right, you see the attitude about Clinton or anything else could really have a dramatic effect. She's going up against Charles Ball, a defense analyst, and she's she had to spend $1.6 million last year. In the 22nd district, which is Santa Barbara, Southern California, you have a situation there where I guess the seat had been occupied by Representative Andrea Seastrand, who is really quite far right, bought into all the conspiratorial theories about the end of the world, you know, the Northridge earthquake and the Malibu fires and floods were not random acts of nature, but the results of the judgment of an angry and vengeful God, according to that former congresswoman. Now, what ended up happening there was that Representative Capps, who won that, passed away while in office, and now his wife, Lois Capps, won the special election, and only 49% of the vote. In that case, she's facing Tom Bordenaro, a state assemblyman, and there's some hope that the GOP can take that seat back, which they've held for 50 years. There's a libertarian in that contest as well, Robert Backus, and a reform candidate, Dick Porter, an education consultant. In the 27th district, which is another key race, parts of Pasadena, Glendale, and San Marino and Burbank, this is a very interesting community because you see a tremendous expansion of immigrants in the area, quite successful, becoming part of the political process, changing the dynamic and the mosaic of America from primarily a white enclave to being a one that reflects the diversity of America in the 21st century. In this case, they had a longtime Republican, Representative Carlos Moorhead, and he was one of the most conservative members of Congress and actually voted against President Clinton's impeachment, and he was on the House Judiciary Committee. It's interesting. It's kind of like a Saturn return story because the present Republican in there is Jim Rogan, who won the first term with 50%. He's also on the House Judiciary Committee. And what distinguishes Rogan is that he's gotten a lot of national attention because he's on the Judiciary Committee once again. And he was so concerned about the impeachment inquiry that he said that, and this is a quote, that it was so important that they should just forget about November 3rd, in other words, the election. He's facing Barry Gordon, who apparently is a very polished candidate. He's an actor who was the voice of the Nestle's Quick Bunny and was also the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle voice for Donatello. So this guy's got some traction. The Democrats have a narrow lead in registration there, so there's a chance they could take that back. And to me, if there's a race that's going to be a referendum about the power of the Clinton scandal or non-scandal, this is it, because you clearly have a qualified candidate in the Democrat and a Republican who reflects perhaps the most draconian aspects of the STAR efforts. Now, in District 36, another toss-up, that's Palos Verdes Peninsula in the South Bay, Redondo Beach, Torrance, and LAX airport area. It's been traditionally Republican, but it has a libertarian strain in terms of its cultural attitudes. There you have Representative Jane Harman, had been the incumbent, was defeated in the gubernatorial primary. But again, you see Democrats spending larger and larger amount of money to hold on to the seat with diminishing returns. In her last race, she spent $2.3 million to hold on to that seat. Now she lost, of course, in the gubernatorial primary. So Janice Hahn, a businesswoman, is running, a Democrat, and she's facing Steve Kendall, an assemblyman. He's haunted by $100,000 he took from tobacco back in 1994. And then, of course, perhaps, I guess, one of the nastiest contests of all is the District 46, Orange County, Disneyland, where we see Democrat incumbent Representative Loretta Sanchez, who won her first term with 46% in a bitter challenge that went on for 14 months in the House, where they wrangled over whether or not she was, whether the election could be certified or not. Of course, her opponent in that was Bob Dornan, who did not take defeat very well. And he was first elected in Congress in 1976. And this is a district that has really changed in terms of its makeups, to the point that now you have a 49% Hispanic, 36% white, 18% other, 12% Asian. So you see this real shift going on, and Dornan couldn't keep up with it. What's interesting about that is that he has just continued. He's a former fighter pilot, of course, arch conservative, became a TV talk show host, and his uncle was Jack Haley, the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz. So I don't know what that says about needing a heart or whatever. But again, what we see in California is just a tremendous amount of money being spent more and more all the time, and it seems to close off the debate, and it seems to take a lot of the time for the candidates. So it's really hard to tell whether or not the Hollywood ethic of kind of accepting President Clinton's foibles is going to translate into the Democrat backlash manifesting itself.
Also in California, you have California deciding to bump its presidential primary up 3 weeks, which has created enough concern among Secretary of States around the country that there's going to be a meeting in Washington next month, particularly concerned Massachusetts Secretary of State. California moving to March 7th because Massachusetts and other northeastern states are concerned about diluting attention from the Yankee primary scheduled for the same day.
Right, exactly. What's interesting also is that the effect of the overlay of the gubernatorial races in these situations, because remember, the Republicans have made great progress in state houses. 32 out of the 50 are controlled by the Republicans at this point, meaning that some three-quarters of the nation's population lives in a state where the Republicans control the governor's mansion. In this case, there's some bright light for the Democrats in that it appears that Lieutenant Governor Gray Davis is doing a credible job and is ahead of Lundgren, the Attorney General Dan Lundgren, who is a favorite of conservatives and has continued to hold on to his anti-choice position. And that is turning out to be a handicap for Lundgren at this point. And you also have the top of the ticket, of course, the battle between Senator Barbara Boxer and Matt Fong that is, Fong has really kind of come out of nowhere and seems to be getting traction. So, again, there's an interplay of things here. What role does a governor's campaign play? Will that bring people out? And, again, that's the key question. Who has the discipline to vote?
And speaking of senatorial races, a very close race right now in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Senate race between Senator Russell Feingold, one of the most liberal members of the Senate, known for the McCain-Feingold bill around campaign finance, going up against Congressmember Mark Newman. And it looks like among the issues that Feingold is caught in right now is his urging Newman to adhere to a spending cap of about $3.8 million, which works out to roughly a dollar per person in the state. Feingold's also discouraged Democrats and other groups from using issue advocacy ads to promote his campaign. Newman has no such qualms, has been running fierce ads over the last few months.
Well, actually, it's interesting that Feingold has been getting some support from Odd Quarters. There was a Paul Jugot story in the Wall Street Journal, which kind of made Newman look like a false conservative in terms of as a tax cutter. So I think that Feingold's moment on the national stage should hold him in good stead there. It would be interesting to see what position the Christian Coalition is going to take in that area and what role they play in getting out the vote.
Speaking of the Christian Coalition, Bob Henley, it is very interesting to look at not just what the polls say about impeachment of President Clinton, and we all have heard that the polls are overwhelmingly against impeachment, but who votes? I mean, when you look at the fact that you've got a majority of people against impeachment and giving Clinton some of his highest ratings ever, on the other hand, you've got a minority that may be much more active than the majority.
Exactly right. I think it's kind of an odd algebra, but one we have to pay attention to. You have to keep in mind that President Clinton was elected by 20% of the voters, of the potential voters. And so it's possible in that environment of depressed voter turnout, where you could see less than 50%, that people who exercise focus and discipline and follow through with getting to the polls can certainly amplify their impact far beyond their numbers. I think the other thing to look at is the degree to which, you know, I heard someone crack once that the likes of the Sierra Club and League of Conservation Voters, while it's all very nice to get their endorsements, they don't have the sophistication nor the organization to deliver a pizza, much less the vote. And that's the problem. You see a situation where the Christian Coalition is galvanized, motivated, and they're doing it for free. They're not doing it because they're getting paid. And that's a powerful force in politics.
Finally, let's take a look today, and we're going to be talking about lots of other issues in the coming days, Bob, looking at, for example, referenda around the country. There are a number of women's rights referenda that are up before various states. But let's look at South Carolina and the race there as an indication of where this country is going.
Right. What's very interesting in South Carolina is it's been a march, of course, like the South. It had been primarily Democratic forever. And, of course, you had the Nixon strategy where they turned against the white population by playing up the Democrats' support of civil rights. There's always the continued military spending because so many bases are located there. So when folks retire there, they tend to have a more conservative, militaristic point of the point of view. Now we see Fritz Hollings, longtime incumbent Democrat, very polished. Certainly, your idea when you think of senator, that's what comes to mind. You know, tall, statuesque, you know, a mane of silver hair, going up against this Congressman Inglis, who is Bob Inglis. And Inglis is really kind of a, you might say, a Christian Coalition centurion in that he came to Congress. He does not, he keeps his family in South Carolina. He sleeps on an air mattress in his office, okay? So he wants no contamination from the Beltway or any of the kind of living that I guess President Clinton fell, you know, under two. And the problem here is, of course, once again, it's animated by a local gubernatorial race where you have Governor David Beasley, a Republican, going up against State Senator Jim Hodges, a Democrat. Now, of course, that local race has some interesting issues because Beasley is there's some accusations that appeared in Time magazine about him being unfaithful. So there's a kind of balance of the scandal. It's a kind of an odd Tai Chi. Will Clinton's thing balance off with the allegations about the governor? But what's really sad is that in South Carolina, two of the six seats for the House of Representatives are held by Republicans, and they will be unopposed. So 30% of the population that's African-American who might want to be Democratic are disenfranchised. So I refer to it as Jim Crow 2. Oh, yeah, you've got the vote, but there's nobody to vote for.
And brings us back to a point you raised last time you were on, and this issue of close to 90 races in this country that are unopposed. That is absolutely incredible.
Right.
Well, Bob Henley, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Bob Henley, our campaign correspondent, as we look at congressional races, and particularly how the possibility of impeachment, or at least the impeachment hearings, impinge upon them. Bob Henley, thanks for being with us. Bob's written for the New York Times, for the Village Voice, for the New Jersey Monthly. Thanks, Bob. And interesting point to end on right now. I don't know how many of you got to see the Washington Post yesterday. Full page ad from Larry Flint. Have you had an adult or a sexual encounter with a current member of the United States Congress or a high-ranking government official? Can you provide documentary evidence of illicit sexual relations with a congressman, senator, or other prominent office holder? Larry Flint and Hustler Magazine will pay you up to $1 million if we choose to publish your verified story and use your material. And then they give an 800 hotline or an email address, so if you need some extra money. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute with former South African political prisoner Dennis Brutus. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend, I went down to Washington, D.C. for the annual meeting of the 50 Years is Enough campaign. It's a group that was established several years ago of activists around the world dealing with the issue of globalization and with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Many in these groups have called for the abolition of the IMF. This meeting takes place at the same time that officials from the IMF and the World Bank gather in Washington, D.C. Have their meetings with the World Bank and the IMF, talking about their future. Certainly in headlines today, as we see the crises in Asia, in Russia, in Brazil, etc. On Saturday morning, I had a chance to have breakfast with Dennis Brutus, who is at the 50 Years is Enough campaign meeting. Dennis Brutus, former South African political prisoner, well-known poet and writer. He is now a professor of African literature at Franklin Pierce College in New Hampshire. There he is for just about a semester, is usually at the University of Pittsburgh. And we talked about why he is involved in the issue of globalization and the campaign against the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund practices of today.
You're at the 50 Years is Enough campaign national conference. What is your interest in this?
Well, I think I've been with it right from the beginning, mainly because I understood what the WTO was about. I saw it as a kind of culmination of the Bretton Woods for creation of the World Bank, creation of the International Monetary Fund. And of course, the World Trade Organization, which comes out of those structures, is really a kind of world government. In fact, the director of the WTO on one occasion was quoted as saying, "We are writing a constitution for the whole world." This was around about 1995. And I could see this as a very threatening development in the post-Cold War period. Instead of your East-West confrontation and two superpowers facing each other, you have a single superpower which can now write the global agenda. And the global agenda is Bretton Woods in its new form. And that includes the IMF, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization. So I made a point of going to Halifax, 1995, when we were meeting to take a look. at what was happening at the G7 summit, because a lot of this, of course, is confirmed when the seven most powerful nations in the world get together, seven highly industrialized countries. So that's pretty much it. Where do we go from there?
How does South Africa fit into this picture?
In a very curious way, because one, South Africa is less burdened with debt in the way that many other African countries are. Also, under the apartheid regime, South Africa was rather well treated by the World Bank. They have this habit of lending money to military dictatorships and juntas and minority governments. And the apartheid government was a beneficiary of loans from the World Bank. They also got a rollover. When they said they couldn't repay their debt or service, that they got an extended period. So you have South Africa rather different from most other African countries that come out of the burden of colonialism to neocolonialism to a kind of new enslavement. The new chains are the chains of debt. But in South Africa, they don't have that particular pressure. Surprisingly, though, they have in fact conformed to World Bank policies under Mandela in a way that they probably did not need to. Many African countries suffer what are called SAPs, structural adjustment programs. South Africa has not had one imposed on it, but instead, under people like Trevor Manuel, they've developed their own SAP, a homegrown one, which they call a rationalizing process. But it's very much the same thing. It means downsizing, devaluation of the currency, and priority given to export industry and a neglect of social services. The schools, the hospitals just don't get served.
Who's Trevor Manuel?
Well, he's the Minister of Finance, who also does the kind of planning, overall planning. He came out of the liberation struggle after a fashion. I mean, there were always people within the struggle, fairly conservative views. I don't know too much about his history, and he probably was talking socialism and all kinds of social justice programs at some time in the past. But right now, he's a kind of blue-eyed boy for the World Bank.
When did you go back to South Africa? When did you see what you're describing?
Well, it's interesting. Of course, under the apartheid government, it was illegal for me to return. I had signed an agreement to leave the country and that if I came back, I would go to prison. So I was only able to return after there was a new government.
Actually, before you tell us when you returned, give us a little history of your time in South Africa.
If I must, although I would prefer just to continue that line. In South Africa, it gets very complicated because it begins about 40 years ago, 1958, October, the first Saturday in October. I became the secretary by choice of an organization opposing apartheid in sport. It was the beginning, really, of my involvement with something called the South African Sports Association, which challenged apartheid racism in the Olympic team. Eventually, after about 30 years, we won that one. South Africa was expelled from the Olympics and was not readmitted until 1992, at the time of the Barcelona Olympics. But because of my work in getting South Africa first banned and suspended and eventually expelled, I was arrested in the offices of the South African Olympic Committee at a meeting of the Olympic Committee, which had not yet started. So I didn't think I was committing a crime. But they said, oh, well, even if the meeting hadn't started, I shouldn't be there. So I went to jail for that, spent time on Robben Island, broke stones with Mandela, we were in the same section. And then when I came out, I was put under house arrest. And then after house arrest, I was approached by the special branch, secret police, and offered the exit permit, which meant I agreed to be exiled. So that's where that story ends. And I go to Britain, work in Britain for a while, mainly for political prisoners. I represent them at the UN. I was accredited to the UN as the representative of the Defense and Aid Fund in London. Then begin teaching in the U.S. And then when Mandela becomes president and is released from prison and all that, I was invited back by Mandela, together with all the others who'd been in prison with him on Robben Island, and went to Pretoria to the presidential residence to celebrate his inauguration sort of thing. So I've been back since then a couple of times, including a spell as a visiting professor in Durban, got an honorary Doctor of Literature degree, and in and out. And the last time I went was earlier this year, to the summit of the non-aligned nations, but not to attend the summit, but instead to help launch the Jubilee 2000 South Africa, together with Archbishop Ndungani and Archbishop Dennis Hurley, the Catholic Archbishop. Ndungani had been in prison with me, in fact, on Robben Island, and Hurley and I had been old allies even before I went to prison. So it's a kind of reunion of our own.
Ndungani is replacing Archbishop Desmond Tutu?
Desmond Tutu has become Archbishop Emeritus, which means he's still kind of an archbishop. But the new man is Ndungani, a young man, very pleasant, who reminded me that he saw me on Robben Island. That was the last time he saw me. And he told me about something I'd forgotten, that after I'd been working in the rocks, I'd had my feet slashed, carrying rocks out of the sea. And when he saw me, the guards were pouring iodine into the slashes, you know, the wounds. This was supposedly treatment. I'd forgotten about it, but he reminded me of it.
So you went back for the inauguration of Nelson Mandela. And what did you see and what have you seen since when you've gone back in terms of the state of your country?
Well, as I say, I've been back several times. I think what most shocked me was flying into Cape Town, looking down and seeing miles and miles of what looked like garbage on the beach as we were landing. It turned out to be shacks and shanties and bits of plastic and cardboard that people had constructed, temporary homes, you know? And there must have been a couple of thousand of them stretching for miles. And I said, you know, this is what you saw under apartheid, and it didn't surprise you. But to see it years later, in the post-apartheid era, this, I think, I had a sense of the lack of progress, but I think it was the impact of this particular image, just seeing it from the air and then finding out what it was about, that I found most troubling. And then, of course, the beggars in the streets of New Johannesburg, white and black, unemployed, you know, little styrofoam cups begging for your change. And of course, the violence. I had a knife stuck in my ribs in Johannesburg and my watch taken off my arm, you know. So you see it's all there, and you don't see it theoretically. You see it very graphically, very physically, and you start asking questions about it. I suppose the other incident that has made a very strong impact on me was this year, going back and sitting in on the sessions of the TRC, Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The day I walked in there, the man testifying was the man they called Dr. Death. This is the man who developed the viruses for killing people, stabbing them with the tip of an umbrella or a fountain pen, or developed gallons of cholera and anthrax. And he sat there calmly recounting what he'd done. No regret, no apology. You know, this is what we did in our lab. You know? And all that seems to me horribly unsatisfying, of course, and wrong. So clearly there are serious problems in the polity as a whole, but I think specifically in the area of economics. joblessness, homelessness, unemployment, the cost of bread and milk going up where people can't afford it. This is the third world all over again. This is the South, you know, as we know it today. So South Africa is very much a problem area.
Our guest is Dennis Brutus, former political prisoner in South Africa, now a professor of African literature in the United States. He's at Franklin Pierce College in New Hampshire for a semester. We're here in Washington at the 50 Years is Enough campaign weekend, U.S. Network for Global Economic Justice. We talked with some of the organizers of the event on Friday. Today we bring you Dennis Brutus. So you see the situation in South Africa, that it is truly a part of what is called the third world in terms of its economic situation. Why is it like this today?
That's a difficult one, because it seems to me that the roots are probably in the transitional period and in the deals that were made about post-apartheid South Africa. In the process when power was transferred from the old apartheid regime to the new government. I'll give you just one example. The current government, the Mandela government, has agreed to inherit all the debts incurred by the apartheid government. And some of these, over 600 million, for instance, was lent to South Africa very shortly before the transition. And much of it went into giving golden handshakes to the white South Africans of the apartheid regime who were running the political machine and the army and the secret police. They've all got these handsome, you know, golden parachutes. But all that debt, which was acquired by the apartheid regime before it gave up power, now has to be repaid by the Mandela government. So in a sense, we're paying a second time for our oppression. But in addition, ironically, this item is either number one or two on the national budget. So that the repayment, the servicing of these loans takes priority over schools, hospitals, clinics, even roads, social services, because they first have to pay the World Bank what they owe them, or the internal debt, which was part of this foreign debt process via South Africa's banks and their insurance companies, whatever. So you have this irony that the people of South Africa have to get in line and wait their turn until the servicing of the debt is handled annually. This is one of the things Trevor Manuel is very strong about. But unfortunately, not only Trevor Manuel, but also Govan Mbeki, who is the man who is going to succeed Mandela, if Mandela's way is his choice for his successor, deputy president at the moment. So what we have, I think, is that much of this, including something called a sunset clause, was negotiated prior to the transfer of power. Sunset clause is the one which says that none of the civil servants in the apartheid government could be fired. They had their jobs for life under the new government. But of course they might choose to resign, or you could give them a golden handshake and persuade them to retire. But otherwise we're stuck with them even now. In the post-apartheid era, we're still dealing with civil servants who are holdovers from the old regime.
What does Mandela, President Mandela, have to say about the self-imposed structural adjustment program in South Africa?
I've had difficulty in finding specific references in his speeches to it, so I'm going to try and just pick out three which may or may not be helpful. I found it very useful that earlier this year, you know, we had the major demonstration at the summit in Birmingham, 70,000 people on the streets of Birmingham.
This was the G7 summit?
G7, or as they call it, G8, because the Russians were dragged in. But from there, Mandela went to Cardiff. I missed this. I was in Birmingham, but I was not in Cardiff. And he spoke at a kind of a mini summit. I think it was the Commonwealth, British Commonwealth countries. And there he reminded his audience that South Africa had inherited a burden of debt. I think he quoted the figure of about $42 billion, or rand, probably dollars. But certainly there was a very specific reference to debt. So that's one area where he's spoken about it. On the other hand, when the non-aligned nations met in Durban this year, 113 or thereabouts, their final communique had no reference to debt at all, and he was presiding. So this is an occasion where they ignored the issue of debt. Interestingly, and this is not quite related, but allow me to insert it, while I was there, I had raised the question of why Thabo Mbeki had not addressed the question of debt. And subsequent to my interview, he was interviewed. And so they asked Mbeki, you know, how do you explain the fact that you were expected to raise the question of debt and never did? And he answered it in two ways, as far as I know. He said, one, he approves of the cancellation of debt or something like that in terms of the poor nations. But apparently South Africa is not one of the poor nations, and so he didn't think it applied to South Africa. That's what I've been told. I didn't hear the actual interview myself.
You're listening to Dennis Brutus, former South African political prisoner, well-known writer and poet. We spoke this weekend at the 50 Years is Enough campaign national meeting in Washington. We'll continue with him in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we bring you part two of the interview with Dennis Brutus. Dennis Brutus, poet, former South African political prisoner, broke rocks with Nelson Mandela at Robben Island, now a professor at Franklin Pierce College in New Hampshire. As we spoke this weekend at the 50 Years is Enough campaign national meeting, this coinciding with the meetings this week of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C.
Can you explain Jubilee 2000?
Yes, it's essentially a religious concept. And the catch there is that some of the best activists in the world are not religious people. So one has to face that. That's a separate issue, I think, but let's just stick to the bare bones. From the book of Leviticus in the Bible, I think chapter 25, there is this notion in the Old Testament that in a jubilee year, which might be every 10th year, every 50th year, or in this case, every 100th year, but also every 1,000th year, we're going into the third millennium. The idea is that you forgive all debts, you repair all wrongs, and you celebrate this kind of completion of a cycle. So the notion of a jubilee here is twofold. It's a celebration of the end of a cycle, but it's also an act of generosity, an act of forgiveness, an act of amending whatever damage has been done, whatever repairs need to be made. So using that quotation, churches initially launched Jubilee 2000. Desmond Tutu is one of the great spokesmen for that variation of the idea. But for many people who are not religious, they're also concerned with the whole question of a burden of debt which is literally unrepayable. Africa owes the World Bank over $200 billion. They are never going to be able to repay it. They're struggling even just to pay the interest on that debt. In fact, most of them can only pay a fraction of the interest. So you have the capital debt plus an accumulation of the unpaid interest. And they are required to give up to 30% of their annual income in repayment of the servicing of the debt and postponing, of course, hospitals and housing and education, social services. So for some of us, it's a matter of simple logic. They will never be able to repay the debt. The mountain is growing. And the sensible thing is to cancel it, particularly as so much of it was unjustly loaded on them by dictatorships that did not consult them, money that went into the purchase of arms, money that ended up in banks in Switzerland, so that we have a whole range of reasons why we think it ought to be cancelled. So whether you're coming from a religious viewpoint or pragmatic viewpoint, it seems to me it makes sense to say by the year 2000 we want these debts cancelled.
How big a movement is it in South Africa?
South Africa is just beginning, because we have another rather curious problem, that when you have a government to which most people are loyal, saying, well, we don't think we ought to repudiate this debt, and people think it ought to be repudiated, but they're torn between taking that position and being critical of a government they don't want to criticize, it creates a new problem. Initially, we've got a fair amount. Well, there are three major components at the moment. There's cancer, which I mentioned earlier. There's something based in Cape Town called the Alternative Information and Development Center. And then there are the people from Jubilee 2000 groups. Numerically, not very big, but growing. What is interesting, I think, is that there's a lot of potential support within the trade union movement. The trade unions, COSATU, and portions of COSATU are saying, we don't want to pay this debt. We don't think we should pay this debt. So right now there's a debate within COSATU, Congress of South African Trade Unions, and some of them are moving over to join Jubilee 2000. That, I think, will be significant. The time, I think, will come when the Mandela government or the Mbeki government will repudiate the debt. But I think it will only come after grassroots pressure. It's got to come from below, not from the top.
Last night at the 50 Years is Enough plenary session, you read two poems, and I was wondering if you could read them for our listeners.
Right. I should say that I was a little thrown by the request by Njoki. I wasn't prepared to do two poems, and when you're going to do poems, you have to kind of lead into them. But what that means is you really can't develop a practical, logical kind of political statement. There's a difference in quality, which I hope you sympathize with. So here are the two poems. The one is really just a fragment of verse on the notion of endurance. And it goes like this. Endurance is the ultimate virtue. More, the essential thread on which existence is strung, when one is stripped to nothing else, and not to endure is to end in despair. Okay, that's the first one. Second one is actually the title poem of my last collection, which is called Still the Sirens. And I'm talking about the sirens of the police cars and the military coming into the ghettos and the townships. And this was what I heard growing up in South Africa. 60 years later, I go back, and I still hear the sirens. But surprisingly, of course, This is under a new political regime. And I'm saying that I don't see that much change between the oppression of the past and the hardships that people are suffering today. And we have not yet reached the freedom that people talk about. Here's the poem. Still the sirens stitch the night air with terror, pierce hearing's membranes with shrieks of pain and fear. Still they weave the mesh that traps the heart in anguish, flash bright bars of power that cage memory in mourning and loss. Still sirens haunt the night air. Someday there will be peace. Someday the sirens will be still. Someday we will be free.
When you introduced the first poem, you talked about what it was for you to endure in South Africa, particularly when you were kept under house arrest.
That's true, because it was very frustrating to be in the country, to watch what was happening, and not to be able to participate in it, not to be able to be actively involved. That was a particularly bad period for me, a period of frustration, because I could neither work nor write, nor take part in any kind of political activity.
People hear the words, house arrest, but I don't think we really comprehend what it is. You just stay in your house all the time?
More than that, if you leave by the door, if you step out one step, it's a crime. You can be arrested for just stepping outside the building. Two, because you may not have visitors, anybody in that house cannot have a visitor either. Their visitor might talk to you. So my family, for instance, were not allowed to have visitors. And if someone came by accident or by design to the house, I would be arrested for violation of my house arrest order. It was a very tricky situation.
And how long were you in under house arrest for?
Fortunately, although the order was for 5 years, I only served 1 year because then they approached me and offered me the exit permit, the ability to leave.
How could they control whether you wrote or not?
Well, the law said that it was a crime for me anything that might be published, which meant if they found anything in my handwriting, for instance, they could always say, well, it might be published. So it could be a draft, it could be a note. The one interesting exception, of course, was that I was not forbidden to write letters. And so I wrote poems and called them letters. In fact, my collection, which is called Letters to Martha, is a collection of poems I wrote and sent to my sister-in-law. My brother Wilfred went to Robben Island and I came out. So I sent her these poems describing the experience in prison, so that she would have some idea of it. But because I call them letters rather than poems, they became legal.
Dennis Brutus, you talked about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and going back and seeing Dr. Death, the man in charge of the chemical warfare program in apartheid South Africa. Could you say a little more about that and what you think of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
It's a very difficult issue because obviously there are divided opinions on it. And if you read the media, the sense you get is of people feeling that it worked, that it established what the truth was and that it achieved reconciliation. But if you talk to the people, particularly the parents of teenagers who were murdered and whose bodies were never found, they will say to you that the wounds were opened, but that they were never healed, that all that the commission did was to drag the truth out, in a sense that one knows more now than one knew before, but that there's been no healing. And I think what troubles them especially is that the law creating the commission was framed in a way that you only had to admit what you had done. You didn't have to express remorse or regret or sorrow or apologize. And so you had these death squads, really, hit men, assassinations, being described calmly by these people. And then they walk away, smiling, you know, with amnesty, because they've been granted amnesty. So although Desmond Tutu, for one, would defend the process, and he chaired it, and even he, I think, has some misgivings, because you must remember, at the time he was made the chair of it, he was not told of all the kinds of regulations governing the commission. I mean, the finer details are things they worked out later. My own view is that it was a device to ensure that the criminals did not get punishment. This was not The Hague. This was not Nuremberg, you know. These were people guilty of genocide or of planning genocide who were assured in advance in the negotiations with Mandela that there will be a process by which you can escape punishment. And this is what amnesty has amounted to.
Do you put any weight in acknowledgement?
Perhaps.
Acknowledgement of crimes?
Right, that's very interesting. I think we're talking about two kinds of acknowledgement. The people who committed the crimes, of course, have to say we committed them. They don't have to say we're sorry they did them. But more importantly, for white South Africa, they know now what crimes were committed in their name and in order to preserve their power. White supremacy depended on killing your opposition and making sure it didn't function successfully. So many white South Africans now have to say these things were done in order to protect us and to preserve our privileges. And then, of course, they have to deal with that. Now, some of them, I find, are unable to deal with it, so they leave the country. Unfortunately, when they leave, they take all their assets and their wealth with them. So in a very serious way, they impact on the country again in an unfortunate way. There are also, of course, white South Africans, as there were white Nazis in Germany, who said, we didn't know what was being done, you know, and therefore we can take no blame for it. Perhaps the most troubling ones are the ones who say, I did it, but I did it under orders, so you have to blame the people who gave me the orders. And of course, the de Klerks and the Botha's are already scot-free. They already have amnesty. So you can't punish the source of the crime. And those who executed the crime are already exonerated, because they say, we didn't want to do it, we were told to do it, and we were just following orders. This is Nazi Germany all over again.
Dennis Brutus, poet, writer, former political prisoner in South Africa on Robben Island with Nelson Mandela, speaking this weekend at the 50 Years is Enough campaign meeting in Washington, D.C., as he talked about the debt of Africa, particularly South Africa, and how that debt should be forgiven. If you'd like a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Tomorrow on Democracy Now! We speak with Pierre Sané, who is the General Secretary of Amnesty International, and their groundbreaking report, Rights for All, a look at human rights abuses in the United States. Julie Drizin's our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!